And this is Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here. One more week on News Dissector Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. I'm here every Thursday at this time at 5 o'clock, and I'm pleased that you could be with us. We have a very important and interesting show for you this week. We're going to be talking about the lead story, the number one problem that remains for many millions of Americans, housing, affordable housing, and dealing and coping with foreclosures from all sorts of subprime mortgages that they were victimized by. So we're going to hear about that, and here to tell us about it will be Bruce Marks, the executive director, the president, the major domo, and I see him in the window here, of NACA, the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America. And Bruce is going to be on the program with us, taking some questions, taking your calls, and talking about President Obama's announced plan about housing, which seems to be a continuation of failed plans. We'll hear about that. And then in the second half hour, you'll meet Alan Weider. Alan Weider is someone who's just published a book with Monthly Review Press, Ruth First and Joe Slovo in the War Against Apartheid. If you haven't heard those names, you're going to find this fascinating. If you have heard these names, you'll find it informative. So stay with us here on News Dissector Radio.
I pledge allegiance to the card of the United States of Credit. One nation under debt, with bankruptcies, late fees, and high interest for all.
We're doomed to shop till we drop.
Shopping is the American addiction. Borrowing and debt.
In debt, we trust.
It's kind of hard to serve the master and MasterCard.
Just need your signature right here, please.
The gospel of shopping. The gospel of buying things.
Our society has been really set up to keep us struggling and not give us relief.
In debt, we trust.
The national savings rate is now zero.
It's just making my family even more poor.
Now let's see just how shopping can be fun. Real fun.
To shop till we drop.
Yeah, you get free money.
Shop till you drop. That's from my film, In Debt We Trust, 2006, predicting the financial crisis. I was told at the time that I was, in fact, you know, a doom and gloomer. I was an alarmist. I didn't know what I was talking about. Then a year later, I became, a genius for being able to predict something that seems so obvious to anybody who'd been following this in any length. We have a guest coming in. Let bring her in if we can. We want to introduce now again Bruce. Bruce, you know, call your attention to the New York Times yesterday. The New York Times front page, I've never seen this quite before, front page of the New York Times, the lead story, but it's not a story. It's a news analysis about paralysis. It's about Washington stepping warily, nice word, on housing. Obama raises issues of home financing and seems to be focusing more and more on privatized solutions, trying to limit the government role. Give us a little picture, first of all, of your organization, NACA, because when I was involved with you a few years back, you know, NACA was a major force, but I'm sure it's an even bigger force in the housing movement today. And you know, a movement that not only talks about policy, but actually helps people get mortgages that are affordable and get homes that are affordable and stop the ripoffs that are so pervasive. So also, sure. Nyesha Lang is here in the house with us, joining me here today. And, she came a little late, but we're going to get her into the flow as well. So, Bruce, tell us a little bit about your organization and as you see it, the state of the housing disaster in America now.
Sure. Well, Danny, it's good to see you.
There you go.
It's really been a while. I think, you know, I remember back to the first event that we did. It was in Washington, D.C. It was at the Capitol Hilton Hotel, July 17th of 2008. And at that event, we had, literally thousands and thousands of homeowners. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, we had 8,000 people lined up in front of the Capitol Hilton Hotel. And the reason why The Washington Post did a big story on what NAC is doing out there is because they couldn't get into their own building because there was a line of people going by the Washington Post, and they said, what are people there for? And I remember that we went up to Congress. We had thousands of people going up there and, you know, in the Capitol Hilton Hotel, and we were the first out there. NACA was the first to actually begin the modifications of mortgages, and we were the first to say that the answer is not the refinancing of these mortgages that were restructured to fail, but it was really about changing the terms by reducing the interest rate to as low as 2%, to reducing the outstanding principal to get an affordable payment. And that was the first event, Danny, that we did there. And since then, we have done 116 American Dream events. And what these events are is over a five-day period. We have all the banks there. All the banks are there. And we have the NACA advocates there. And we are saving people on site $500 a month, maybe over $1,000 a month in their mortgage payments. And as we speak now, we're at the Meadowlands doing another event. We got the banks there. We started today. We go through Monday. And, you know, everything is
free. We're at the Meadowlands. We're at the
Exposition Center to do that. We're there from 8 in the morning to 6 o'clock at night. But just think of what we've been doing, because I started NACA 25 years ago. We're a nonprofit organization. We're the largest housing counseling organization in the country. We're HUD certified. So of the 2,600 HUD certified counseling agencies, we're one, but we do over one-third, 30% of all the counseling in the country. We have over 600 staff people. So what we are doing is we're saying housing is a right. Well, what does it mean? You remember back in the 60s and 70s where we would be going saying housing is a right? Well, we're making it a reality, because what we're saying is that if you're a home buyer and you go through NACA, we'll guarantee that you'll be a homeowner at some point, because look at this product that we have. No down payment, no closing costs, no fees. We don't consider someone's credit score. We look at their individual circumstances, and it's always at a below market interest rate, the lowest in the industry. And if you stick with NACA, you will be a homeowner. And if you stick with NACA, we're going to advocate for you if you're a homeowner now to get an affordable payment. That's not possible. You can always go through a purchase program. So we're getting to the point where we're saying if you go through NACA, we're setting the standard for the country in terms of affordable home ownership. And then when you look at the piece that you're talking about of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, right?
Yeah, but before sure. we get there, let me, you know, you're talking about your organization and all what you're doing, but I wanted to just talk about the human beings, the faces of the people that I saw at that event in Washington. You know, when I came to that hotel, I had a feeling I had been there before. I didn't remember when. But in fact, that was the hotel of the March on Washington of 1963. And there was actually a little display in the lobby of the people. This is where Malcolm X met Martin Luther King. This is where all the SNCC activists from the South came and, you know, were in the hotel rooms, you know, 8 to a room, 9 to a room, you know, spending the night after the March on Washington. And I was there that night. And I remember it well. And I felt like this is the rebirth of a whole movement that has not been recognized, but it reflecting the realities of so many people's lives. The entire, you know, it seemed as if the entire black middle class of Washington, D.C. was there with their papers, with their mortgage papers, with their stories about how they had been screwed over by banks, how they had been desperate to stay in their houses, and they had nowhere to go until, you know, NACA showed up, and they were there, thousands. I mean, it wasn't like 10 people. It was jammed.
But you know, it was amazing because, you know, one of the things is because we didn't expect that many people, right? So here you have, it's a, you know, beautiful hotel, Capitol Hilton Hotel, right? People are in the ballroom till 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, just circling each other, waiting to meet with a NACA counselor, waiting to get their mortgages restructured. And you know what? But it also was a contrast in that what's the building next door to the Capitol Hilton Hotel? Not the White House. It's the AFL-CIO. And it was hot out there. It was hot during the days. And, you know, and I come from the union movement, as do you. But they didn't open their doors. And I think, you know, in some ways you got to say, is that a reflection of what's going on as well? But the point is,
and also on the other street, across the street on the other side, was the headquarters of the Washington Post, which was also oblivious by and large about this problem, and the problem came to them directly. They were confronted by people, and these were people who were teachers, lawyers, even people who were, you know, thought they had the security of a home, and then found that they
didn't. But they were all part of what were they a part of? They were all part of a home ownership deception scheme. Because if you look at those products, Danny, as you know and as you've written about, those products, if you have an interest-only mortgage, that's not home ownership. That's just getting money out of you until you foreclose. If you have a negative amortization where you're paying less each month than the mortgage, what's that? That means you're going to lose your house eventually. It was a Wall Street scheme to say, let's get these mortgages out there. But there was no real true home ownership there. It was just eventually you're going to be foreclosed on. And as you're saying, the people who were there were not homeless people, weren't poorer people. They were working people, middle class people for the most part, who said, I bought into the American dream. I did that. And now I have this mortgage. And when at 4 o'clock in the morning, I remember I'm out there at 4 o'clock in the morning, get 8,000 people out there were saying, boy, we've hit something, a nerve out there that we knew and you knew, but the people showed up.
But these were people who worked for the government. These were people who worked at the Pentagon. These were people who, you know, on the surface appeared to be middle-class, stable citizens. But privately, they didn't know if they could afford to stay in their homes for another month. And it wasn't just their homes. It's, you know, their kids go to school in a certain district and all the rest of it. And one of the things that all of these schemes, as you call them, you know, were legalized by lawyers. You're a lawyer. How do you see this? How could lawyers have been so much a part of what was clearly, you know, a fraudulent enterprise?
You know, there's a gray line when you talk about fraud and corporate law. And, you know, I think to a large extent, this is a bubble that burst after the Silicon Valley bubble, right? And so this was the work that sustained lawyers coming out of law school for, you know, almost a decade in the late 90s to when this happened, when the global meltdown happened. And what we knew was that these deals were syndicated and that there were several parties involved. It's the same thing that happens in public in affordable housing. Those deals are syndicated as well, and there's a number of parties getting involved. And except the difference is in that case, there's a subsidy. In this case, there's no subsidy. There's extra money going into the pockets of the people who had this loan.
Yeah, I mean, these banks.
But it's really very simple, because really the lawyers just do what lawyers do. They just sign off on the documents and make it legal, or they try to and all that. But it's very simple, because you're exactly right. If you look after the high-tech bubble burst, then what does Wall Street do? They want to say, what is the next big thing? Well, if you remember back then, in, you know, 15 years ago, what was the most valuable asset in the world? Was it gold? Was it silver? Or was it American real estate? Because at that point, because if you look at the commodities, they go up and down in value. But back then, American real estate never goes down.
And remember, we're starting from the Homestead Act. This was a decision by the federal government to make housing the main commodity.
And that it had never gone down in all the regions. So even if it goes down in New York City, well, it's going to be flying high in California and in Ohio. So it'll never go down. So what did Wall Street do? They said, I'm going to create a commodity that I can sell out there to the investors around the world. And investors were clamoring for this thing called American real estate. And the problem that Wall Street had was that they didn't have enough of the product. That's the product of mortgages. So they had to create more and more product. Well, to do that, you had to get people to do different types of financing, whether it's a negative amortization, it was a interest only, negative amortization loan, a mortgage that is interest rate that is at a low rate, a teaser rate that goes up. And they just wanted to generate more and more product mortgages because there's such a demand by investors across the board. And they did. But at some point, they went so far, because that's what Wall Street always does. They always go, take it just too far. And then they said, we're going to have a product that is a no-doc product.
Right.
We don't care what your income is. We don't care what is the documentation. We're just going to put it together, make it out of whole cloth. There's nothing there. And then even investors were buying that. They had one problem. And this happened. There's a date out there. February of 2007. What happened in February of 2007? Well, all of a sudden, those no-doc mortgages, people weren't paying. But, you know, all those mortgages that were out there that people were paying on. So it's not that after February 2007 there were different mortgages. It's that those mortgages where someone's making a $1,000 a month mortgage payment and making it on time because they were qualified for a $1,000 a month mortgage payment. Well, when that mortgage payment goes to $1,500 a month, when it goes to $2,000 a month, when I was only qualified for $1,000, and those, you know, brokers lied to me and said, oh, don't worry, you can refinance. And they got lawyers and people to sign off on the dotted line. But they used the credibility of institutions that people thought we could trust. We could trust a Countrywide. We could trust a Wells Fargo. We could trust a GMAC, a Chase, a Citi. But, of course, we couldn't.
It's a great explanation. I think another aspect was that these loans were assignable. And through whatever, you know, amount of paperwork was passed through the hands of Bear Stearns and the banks, the loans ended up in other people's hands who weren't responsible.
But it was a brilliant scheme. Because, you know, they always blame the homeowners. They always blame working people. But you have these Harvard-educated lawyers and investors. You got the Wall Street executives. And what's their argument? What do they say? They said, well, we didn't know. We thought that the rating agency said we gave a AAA rating, and that was good enough. Well, you know, what's the argument? Either you're going to say I'm a complete idiot, and therefore I didn't do my homework, or I'm so greedy that I didn't care. But you can't have it both ways. Either you're Harvard-educated and you have all these credentials, then stand up and say I'm a complete lazy idiot. Or the other side saying, you know, I knew it was that way, but I was so greedy that I was bought and paid for.
Now, Bruce, the media was also selling this. The industry had bought tremendous amounts of advertising on television and radio for these loan products. And, you know, the idea that, you know, that anybody could have, didn't matter if you had any money at all, you could have a beautiful home. You know, it's a very attractive idea to people who have never had anything.
But the point is that that's right. You're exactly right, because if I'm a home owner or home buyer, right, someone comes to me and, you know, if I'm low to moderate income and they said, look, I am Chase, I'm Wells Fargo, I'm Bank of America or Countrywide and all that, and say, you can live in a community where it's safe, you got good schools, you know, you can have a beautiful house, and, you know, I'm not a loan shark on the corner, or we didn't think they were, because we have this perception of a loan shark that if you don't make your mortgage payments, we're going to come and we're going to break your legs. Well, these guys were actually worse than loan sharks. But of course, you can't blame the homeowners because everybody signed on. The regulators thought it was the right thing to do. Democrats and Republicans said it was the right thing to do. The media said it was the right thing to do. All these lawyers said it was the right thing to do. But I testified, and you were there, I testified on September 12th of 2000. 13 years ago in front of the House Financial Services Committee. And that testimony, you can read it today, and it says, if you allow Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to engage in the subprime lending, the taxpayer will bail them out and it will be a financial disaster. Because what was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac doing? They said because they were owned not by, they had the government guarantee, the taxpayer guarantee, but what were they saying? They were owned by stockholders, by Wall Street. And Wall Street says you're not getting enough of a return. So what did they do? They said, we're going to buy of our portfolio, 30% of our portfolio is going to be Countrywide predatory loans. Countrywide predatory loans out there. And that's why they went under. But it was known. It was known. But everybody was milking this for huge amounts of money.
Let me jump into this for a second, because we want to know a little bit more about you, Bruce, okay? Here you are. You actually work for the Federal Reserve Bank here in New York. You were an up-and-coming financial bureaucrat, whatever they call them, banker possibly, and what have you. And then you became you know, the renegade. You became the person that every banker, certainly in Boston and then in other parts of the country, feared because you took this issue right into their backyard. I remember marching with you into the headquarters of Bear Stearns before the bank collapsed, and you looked at those guys in their white shirts and ties, and you said, guys, we're out here now protesting. You're going to be with us very soon. Join us, you know, and they spurned you. They looked the other way. And of course, you know, 40% of them were laid off within 2 weeks, whatever happened. How did you, what's your history in terms of the learning curve that you went through on this issue?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I'm a product of the 70s, you know, so, you know, as an activist fighting for economic justice. So I did an MBA at NYU, and I went there to learn the enemy. So I said, I'm going to do an MBA. I'm going to go. And, you know, and when you're at NYU, you get all the Wall Street financial people there. So I wanted to learn that. And then I got a job at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. So I was in the domestic applications area, but I went in there, you know, to say, I want to learn the enemy. You know, I had an agenda to do that. So, you know, and in the applications area, you oversee the biggest banks in the world, the biggest financial institutions in the world. And everything comes through the applications area. So you're getting their financial information, you're getting their legal, you're getting their competitive analysis, all that stuff, their what they call the CAMO analysis, capital, asset management, equity, liquidity. So you learn that piece. And what you learn is that everyone was doing something illegal. And it was public information. Now, I also had access to the confidential information. So learned that, I said, okay, learned that, and then I went out, I started working with the Hotel Workers Union, and we started fighting for, you know, housing benefit for the hotel workers. But even with that, we learned about subprime mortgages out there. So I learned that when I was in Boston. To make a long story short, because, you know, we don't have many, many hours to go through that, but there is a person that came to me, Miles Iyami, said, do you know about hard lending? Hard lending. So we were actually, as has been written, I coined the term predatory lending back in the late 80s, early 90s. And I didn't even know I was the first. I said it, and then there are books written.
What's interesting to me, though, what impressed me about Bruce and still does, is that, you know, there was a protest dimension of all of this. You were an activist. You were challenging the banks. You were helping people understand what was happening to them and getting them involved. But you didn't stop there. You began to develop services and programs that actually can empower people and can help them financially. In other words, you had a service aspect to this, almost like the Black Panther Party breakfast program. You
Absolutely.
Were out there with concrete projects. Other people were making noise. You made some noise, but you also, you know, in a sense, put these guys up against the wall, and you were successful.
You know, there are.
Am I wrong?
No, you're exactly right. There are a lot of good ideas out there, and we don't have all the ideas, and we don't necessarily have the best ideas. But you know, you also have to do the advocacy to make sure that your ideas are implemented. So yes, absolutely. And we have a purchase program that's the best in the country. We have modified and saved over 250,000, a quarter of a million homeowners in their homes getting affordable solutions. But you can't do that just because you do good operations. You have to do the advocacy, just as you're saying, Danny. So, you know, when you're talking about Bear Stearns, and I smile, because, you know, we saw that Bear Stearns was getting away with literally murder out there. So what did we do? Within less than a month, we organized, and we had over 250 people go into Bear Stearns, but we went in through the subway system. So while we had people going through the front door, then we also had people coming in through the subways, and we took over their lobby, the Bear Stearns lobby, and we literally held them hostage in their own offices for an hour and a half. The cops come. First thing the cops said, well, you should tell us in advance and, you know, all that stuff.
We didn't know they were coming to do that.
And the cops and the security people, they let us stay. I mean, we went to John Mack's house, head of Morgan Stanley. You know, we went there. The cops let us stay. They let us go there because they were also impacting.
They were getting screwed and all that.
So, and we do it in Washington because you're exactly right, Danny. If you can do the best operations, have the best idea, but if you don't take on these predators and you don't make it personal, and we engage in what we call nonviolent bank terrorism. Well, nonviolent bank terrorism means that you hold the CEOs personally responsible for their actions. They're making $10, $15 million a year. They have hundreds of millions of dollars in assets. Well, there's a responsibility that they have. So isn't part of their responsibility that they meet with the homeowners? Isn't part of the responsibility on Sunday morning, family day, we bring 400 to 500 homeowners to their front door and we say, we want you to understand the consequences of your actions. We want you to look these families in their eyes and their children as well. We want to say, is this what you're about? Foreclosing on their homes. And because of our nonviolent bank terrorism, in our operations, we built this organization.
Yeah, for people who are interested in more information, check out their website, NACA.com, N-A-C-A.com. But also, my film, In Debt We Trust, documents some of their actions. And I've met some of these people, amazing people, really stand-up people who were, you know, very passionate, very supportive of each other, very interracial movement. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't demagogic. It was very practical in terms of its focus and very militant in terms of its methods. And I was really amazed by that. Now, we're coming to the end of this half hour. It's moved so quickly. But I just want to get back here to President Obama, the immediate situation that we're in right now. What is he doing? What should he be doing?
Well, you know, I supported President Obama, but he's been a huge disappointment out there, because he cannot blame the Republicans for the problem, for not helping 4 to 5 million homeowners at risk to lose their homes, because there's $50 billion that was money dedicated for the HAMP program that was never used to help the homeowners. And 3.5 years ago, when he stood in Phoenix, where he just made the last announcement, and he said, I'm going to make this work. I'm going to stop the foreclosures. I'm going to help people. And it never happened. It never happened. And it was on his watch, within his control to do that. Because when he, even before he took office for the first term, he backed off his promise to do a foreclosure moratorium, because that was getting done in Congress. He consciously undermined that piece. And so he has been absolutely a disaster. And now he wants to make it worse. So he failed in helping helping people save their homes. But now what he wants to say is that Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, and the government, they do 87% of the mortgages in this country. And they do virtually every one for low and moderate income people. Either it's guaranteed or they do it directly. Now he wants to say, I want to minimize your role, and I want to bring the private sector in there who doesn't do anything for low and moderate income people, only does 13% of the mortgages in the country. So what does that mean? That means there will not be a 30-year fixed mortgage. That means interest rates will go up. And that means the continuing process of working people not being able to purchase homes will accelerate. Because if you go out there now, who's buying the houses out there? It's the same Wall Street hedge funds and the same players who caused this crisis. They're the ones doing it, and President Obama is buying into it. It's a huge disappointment, and it's got to stop.
And it's not just President Obama. It's our friends at the New York Times who headline this as a news analysis, which is missing the real news of who's behind this and who's profiting from it. Last week on our show, Bruce, I don't know if you've seen this book, A Dream Foreclosed, Black America and the Fight for a Place to Call Home. And this young woman, a brilliant young woman, was actually living with people in neighborhoods that were being affected, and she was there for their foreclosures. She documented all of this, and she's confronted a lot of the bankers, and she's done a brilliant book about foreclosure. She was on our show last week. But, you know, this happening the week later, you know, shows that this needs to be resisted, and I could think of no one who can combine sort of theory and action and programmatic, basic programmatic respect than Bruce Marks and NACA, who've been fighting on this on many different levels. And again, he has a Save the American Dream event happening out at the Exposition Center at the Meadowlands this weekend. So if you're hearing this in New York and you're interested in this, go and talk to these people and see what they do and how they help people. And you, how come the banks are working with you? I've always wondered that. Here you were, you know, calling them, you know, being a terrorist, challenging them, but yet they've kind of reached an accommodation with you.
Well, you know, for two very clear reasons that we do extremely well. We don't take no for an answer, and we will take them on personally. And because it is personal, just like Danny, when you met, you know, those homeowners, it's personal. So you got to do everything that you can to make sure that you advocate for them. And that means we'll go to their homes. We'll go to the CEO homes. We don't back off. We're proud. We wear as a badge of honor nonviolent bank terrorism, because the fact of the matter is, you know, no one supports the violent terrorism, but no one likes the bankers anyway. You know, anyway, so the only people that like the bankers is the Obama administration and the members of Congress out there.
Because
so,
they get contributions from them.
But the other side is we do the operations better than the banks. So in essence, they outsource the work to us, because everybody that comes to the NACA event has tried and failed to work with their lender out there. So you have to do both, because if all we did was the protest, then we would have to rely on these creditors to provide a solution, which they don't do. But if we do the operations better than they do, we get their attention, we get their commitment, we get their legally binding contracts, and then we can do the operations for them. So they've outsourced it to NACA.
Well, that's it. Bruce Marks, you just heard him. The man, as I would like to say, who's been fighting this fight and winning. That's the amazing thing. Other people have fought. Acorn was here. They're gone. NACA is still here, and they're doing a great job. And really, people, if you're interested in any of this, check them out. Check out their website, NACA.com. Bruce Marks. Hopefully, we'll have him on again to really get into this in more depth. But I just, you know, called him. He just happened to be in Jersey. He came across the river, and here he is in our studio at Progressive Radio Network. So stay with us. We're going to go to South Africa in the next segment, or hear about South Africa. But we welcome you to hang around and listen to this next segment as well. Danny Schechter, your news dissector, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A.
Okay. It wasn't quite the song I wanted, but that's okay, because we're here together. Nyasha Lang is in the house. Bruce Marks is going to stick around, and we're going to be joined in this half hour by Alan Wider. Alan Wider is a historian, oral historian, who's just published a book with the Monthly Review Press, Ruth First and Joe Slovo in the War Against Apartheid. Now, this is a book about a part of the struggle in South Africa that many Americans are probably unaware of. Everyone knows the name Nelson Mandela. The big movie, A Long Walk to Freedom, is coming out in November. Everybody is hoping that Mandela survives. He's in the hospital. But the names of Ruth First and Joe Slovo may not be as well-known, but certainly in South Africa, they were very well-known because they were part of the struggle. It was a non-racial movement. Joe Slovo was in the Communist Party, but he also ended up in coming up with the solutions that the capitalists in South Africa signed on to in the negotiated settlement. Ruth First was a scholar, journalist, a scholar, a very close friend of mine back in the 60s, and who went to work in Mozambique, teaching and researching African issues, and she was assassinated by the South African hit squads of the apartheid regime. And she was she's a shiro, if you will, somebody who people there have tremendous respect for, as do I, and as do Alan. So thank you for joining us, Alan, and tell us a little bit about what motivated you to tell this story and how you went about doing it.
Thanks, Danny. And you knew it was Weider. I don't know. It came
Weider.
Out Weider. No,
I'm sorry.
Not a big deal. Not a big deal. So I've been.
It's the Zulu pronunciation that I was using. Forgive me. Okay. Okay.
No, I love it. You're totally forgiven. So I've done work in South Africa since '99, and it always I from the beginning of doing work with teachers who fought the apartheid regime, it just astounded me that there was not. A, for lack of a better word, proper book on Ruth and Joe, or Ruth or Joe. I mean, these two people were arguably two of the most important leaders in the struggle against apartheid, and we don't do rankings, but they were so, so important. Ruth and Joe both were unique individuals. In fact, the original title for the book was Partners with Separate Paths, but they were both so clearly focused.
I like the way you use the word, Alan, arguably, because when I knew them, they argued a lot with each other. Okay. They're married. I met them in exile when they were in exile in London, in 1966. Ruth First was a student at the London School of Economics in my class, and that's where I met her, and she became my sort of teacher about South Africa, which is something I've remained engaged with all these years. But she is a brilliant and committed person, a feminist, an activist, as well as a scholar. And she and her husband argued a lot about Stalinism and all the issues of the communist movement and the national liberation movement. But both of them were very close to Nelson Mandela were very friendly with him. And when Ruth died, Mandela wrote a beautiful, beautiful essay about her being killed. And Joe, of course, was part of the ANC negotiating team and part of the leadership of the ANC. So these are people who really made a big imprint in the South African struggle. So go on, Alan, give us a sense of what you think their impact was.
Yeah, I mean, I was asked a number of times, and actually an article came out today in the Cape Times that I did about Ruth and Joe both speaking to the present. And when I was asked to do that, I thought, I'm not going to write what you can't go back and go, what would they say today? But what I thought about doing was that their ideas, their writings, and their actions clearly speak to today. Ruth represented Edward Said's quote of speaking back to power, and she did it all the time, and she did it with Joe, as you said, in terms of arguments about the Soviet Union. She did it in terms of apartheid before she went into exile in 1964. Her muckraking journalism, as it was called before her time, was just incredible, of taking on the government, taking on the things that they did to black South Africans. And then when she left, she continued the same thing. One of the beauties of Ruth First was she didn't back down from taking on her own comrades. Early on, she did that when the ANC banned a newspaper called Bantu World, and she made a point of writing in the newspaper that she wrote in at the time, New Age, that, wait a minute, this is what they do to us all the time. You can't ban journalism. One of Joe's amazing traits, besides being a great strategist, I mean, Joe was one of the main leaders of MK, and he was the head of the.
Let's tell them MK is the armed struggle of the ANC. This is the military wing of the ANC, and many people remarked on the fact that there was a white man as the commander, and he was loved really by everybody, in that movement. Of course, he worked with Chris Hani, who was another leader of the MK and others. This is a movement that had people from every different group, Indian, so-called coloreds, whites, of course, Africans from many different tribal backgrounds, etc., as part of this national liberation struggle. And Ruth and Joe brought not only their passion, but a certain intellectual kind of elan to the movement that I think really served it well.
I think you're totally right. And I think that when I interviewed people, because that's what this book is made up of 130 interviews, as well as obviously other sources. But when I spoke to people that were underground with Joe or people that worked with Ruth at the Guardian newspapers, they were both viewed as teachers. For for young black men and women, Joe's essay, No Middle Ground, affected the black consciousness movement. When I spoke with people that went into the underground, to the MK Underground, they spoke that it was Joe that attracted them. And Joe talked about these young people who were coming out of South Africa in 1976 and 1977 after the Soweto massacre, talked about Joe Sovo bringing them in. And there were a lot of people in the ANC that were very leery of black consciousness coming into the struggle out of the country and leading it back in. Joe wasn't one of them. And it seemed like that was part of Joe's life and Ruth's life all the time. You were one of the young people around Ruth, Danny. I mean, they always seemed to have young people that they taught but didn't micromanage. They worked with people, and Joe was incredible at that. And I think if I talk about Ruth speaking back to power, I like to talk about Joe being able to interact with anyone. And it didn't mean he backed down. It didn't mean, as you know from listening to him and Ruth, it didn't mean that it was a touchy-feely type thing. He stood his ground, but he was willing to talk to people who disagreed with him, which was a unique trait.
He had a great sense of humor. There's a fabulous story about Joe Slovo that he told me, actually. In 1963, there was a famous statement, the winds of change are sweeping across Africa. And Joe Slovo, of course, was part of the ANC, the Communist Party, and they had support from socialist countries that America would not allow these people in because of the McCarran Act, because of the Red Scare and McCarthyism in the United States. And so, of course, they gravitated to the Soviet Union and to East Germany. And in East Germany, Joe Slovo went, and East Germans supported the ANC. Well, at the very end of the East Germany, when the Berlin Wall came down, there was a last meeting of the Communist Party of East Germany, and Joe Slovo was there. And Joe Slovo was known for wearing red socks. That's one of the things that he became famous for. But in this meeting, an old man in the back raised his hand and says, "Comrade Slovo, you probably don't remember me, but when you were here before, in 1963, you told us that you thought that apartheid would end in 6 months. And now it's in 1990. What do you say now?" And Joe Slovo looks at him. He says, "Well, given all the factors and the forces, comrade, given the consciousness of our people, given the situation in South Africa today, I see no reason to change my original estimate of 6 months."
Which he
was right this time, you know.
Yeah,
I'm writing a book now about my experiences with Nelson Mandela, and I've been documenting the making and the meaning of the movie Long Walk to Freedom. And I remembered an event where I was interviewing Joe Slovo on election day in 1994. South Africa is finally having its first democratic election. And he agreed to an interview, and we kept getting postponed. At any rate, we ended up meeting in the ANC boardroom in what was called Luthuli House, named after a former president of the ANC. But it was also, before that, Shell House. It was owned by Shell Oil, who basically sold it to the ANC. Okay, so we're sitting in this room, the inner sanctum of the inner sanctum, and there's nobody there because everybody's out voting, everybody's out involved with the election. Joe Slovo is sitting there, and I'm sitting there with the cameraman. And, you know, he's telling me, you know, he says, "Sometimes I have to feel like I have to pinch myself that this is even happening." And we had no idea that this would happen or that we would come to power through an election. They always thought it would be through an overthrow of the old regime. Of course, they didn't have the military strength to pull that off. And in that conversation, 1994, I said, "What are you worried about now, mostly?" And he basically said, "If our comrades, begin to only look after themselves, become corrupt, that's going to be the end of our movement. We're going to lose the support of the people of South Africa." In other words, this was an issue that wasn't even on the agenda in 1994. It's very much on the agenda today in South Africa. But Joe Slovo saw it very clearly and warned against it very passionately. And this is the kind of person he was. He was, you know, critical, self-critical, and analytical.
And I think that people, I think that so many people today, and even shortly after he told you that, after, because Joe died in 1995, and there's so many people now that think back, and almost right away, yes, Nelson came out of prison, and we all know how important he has been to South Africa and the world. But in a very short time, Oliver Tambo, who was the president of the ANC in exile, Chris Hani was murdered, and Joe Slovo died of cancer in 1995 after struggling with it for a pretty long time, for 4 years. And three of these incredible leaders were gone so quickly. And people still talk about that today. There was just Jay Naidoo did an article. Jay Naidoo was the head of the union wing of the government for a while, Kasutu, and he wrote an article about Hani and Joe just this year in the Mail and Guardian, and how the spirit that they had with other people, in, you know, we could talk about Joe forever and the negotiations and the sunset.
You know, I mean, what's interesting about this is that, you know, Joe Slovo was the South African government called him a KGB colonel. The guy who actually coined that phrase later said, we didn't even know if the KGB had colonels, but it sounded like a good thing, you know, to call him. Most South African people believed this, white people believed, you know, that he was really representing the interests of the Soviet Union. He was their terrorist, that, you know, the face of terrorism to the white South African government. And yet in the negotiations, Slovo was the guy that helped engineer the compromises that really prevented a race war from happening. And I spoke with former President de Klerk, South Africa, and I said, well, what struck you about Joe Slovo? He says, you know, he said, Joe Slovo saved the day. The guy, the very guy he had been condemning for years was the guy who he said, and by the way, was he a communist? You know, he couldn't seem to get the right label to put on him.
Yeah, and de Klerk wanted to ban Joe from the negotiations, so there you have it, you know, I mean, in terms of, and that goes back to, I mean, when he was a lawyer in the late 50s in South Africa, he's the one that spoke to the National Party hierarchy who were lawyers also, and everybody looked at him like, why are you talking to them? But he was able to do that. Now, we could talk forever, Danny, you and I, about some of the flaws that happened between 90 and 94, and of course afterwards, that Joe was, or between them, that Joe was part of. But I think what I try to do is to that Ruth and Joe were both human beings, and they had flaws, but they were so, so important, and they were so committed, and they both gave their lives, Ruth literally, and Joe in so many ways, in terms of family, but it was because that was the focus, and they did believe in a people's democracy. So at the same time that Joe was talking as the housing minister about, you know, that people had to own their own houses, he was also saying that housing's a right and everybody deserves a house.
Well, you haven't been with us in this program because Bruce Marks, who's also been to South Africa, is here, and Bruce has been one of the primary advocates for housing as a right in America. I don't know if you ever met Joe Slovo, but he was the person after, you know, the transition, who actually was the housing minister, actually called me up and was interested in trying to get connected with the cooperative housing movement in America. And, you know, you see the enormity of this problem on a global scale, Bruce.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm just fascinated by the conversation. Just that you guys were able to meet with these leaders is just so impressive because, you know, with all the stuff that we do, you know, we do the protests, we do, you know, the demonstrations, we go to the homes of the CEOs, but it's nothing compared to what the civil rights people did. We're on their shoulders, and what the, you know, Joe Slovo and Nelson Mandela and all those people there, and people gave their lives and were in prison. I mean, we do nothing. I mean, what we think are big deals, What they've done is just extraordinary, and we're just, to this day, we're living on their legacy and what they've done.
And also, this is the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, which was a march for jobs and justice. It wasn't just the march for, you know, against segregation. It was, it had an economic component. The leader of it was A. Philip Randolph, you know, the union leader who led the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And Bayard Rustin was the director of the march. This, you know, and there's going to be, I think August 24th, there's going to be a 50th anniversary of the march. I don't, you know, sort of a symbolic thing, but it's still an important part of our history and something that we ought to learn about, you know, the,
But if I could just say one thing on that, you know, we talk about the legacy and the, the anniversaries, but I think we're coming into a new day. And so I think we're going in really in a circle again, in that while we have talked about the Occupy Wall Street and where has that gone, well, it hasn't gone away. And in a real way, it's getting bigger and bigger. So, yes, it's become dormant in some ways, but because the economic crisis is just getting worse and worse, and all the happy talk out there that we're getting out of that is just happy talk, in that I think we're going to see a new day of activism, of the youth really taking the lead out there, because who can afford? I mean, what's the new issue out there? It is indentured servitude on student debts. And out there, and that's where the new leadership is going to come from the students who say, I can't get a good job, I can't afford my debts, and that's where the new March on Washington and economic crisis is going to be.
I was on Jesse Jackson's radio show last Sunday, and there were these young people from, he wasn't there because he was in Africa, but his daughter was running the show, and there was these guests who are doing these Moral Mondays in North Carolina, young people who are sitting in the state legislature in North Carolina, which is where, you know, I was part of the civil rights movement back in 1962. So, you know, it does come around, Bruce, and I do think
10,000 people last Monday.
You know, I do think that this is a growing movement. The Trayvon Martin murder, so many things are triggering this, but I think the focus that NACA has and the lessons that NACA can teach us about economic justice as being part of all this. The ANC had the Freedom Charter, which was about economic justice, not just racial justice. We need to bring communities who are suffering together to work together to try to bring about change. Do you think, you know, certainly Ruth and Joe were in, you know, came up at a time of severe repression in South Africa. You know, they were, Ruth was in jail. They were Joe was in jail for a time. They were forced out of the country. You know, they were hunted. Ruth was murdered. I mean, you know, this confrontation between justice and human rights and the people who want repression hasn't gone away either, has it, Alan?
No, absolutely not. I was in Port Elizabeth, and I did a launch, although it shouldn't be called a launch, at the Red Location Museum, which is right in the middle of the New Brighton Township. 150 people, 135 of them young African males, were bused in from the three other townships, and it was like a 1980s UDF meeting. It was a bubbling. It felt like Arab Spring. I stepped back and just listened to these young people, and it's not systematic yet for most of them, but it's clearly the issues that you were just talking about in terms of the United States too, that the services aren't delivered, class disparity is greater than it was before, and some of these young people knew the story of Joe Slovo and believed that Joe Slovo and people like him is what they need to, you talked about legacy, that they stand on the backs of those people now. Unfortunately, as I do in the book and Dan O'Mara has written and talked about a lot, many of Joe and Ruth's comrades and also Dan's comrades for that matter and people that you met, Danny, don't believe that. So it's a very, very tough time and you look at the things that President Obama does in terms of poor people here in the United States, and Zoom is not that far away, and I don't want to put it on the presidency, but they're a system. When they bought in to the World Bank and the IMF in the early 90s, and that was definitely a choice, when Nelson agreed to pay the apartheid government's debt, it set a path that is not a path that the people that we've talked about today we're fighting for, and I think that young people in South Africa are ready to make some of those demands. How that will go, obviously, we don't know.
Well, one way it can start is Alan Weider's book, Ruth First and Joe Slovo in the War Against Apartheid. It's has an introduction by Nobel Laureate for Literature Nadine Gordimer. It's available from Monthly Review Press. It's a beautiful book, and I was honored to be asked to, you know, do a blurb for it, and I'm quoted in it as well, and I'm proud to be quoted in it. So thank you for your work, Alan, for keeping these the story alive and sharing it with people. And I hope that as people in our country struggle for change, we look outside our country to find the stories of others in the Caribbean, in Africa, in Asia, or wherever, that we can learn from, and I think that can help us. This program is available in the archive at prn.fm. There's a podcast. You'll be able to listen to it if you found it of interest. Share it with your friends. I'll be posting it tomorrow in my blog at newsdissector.net, you know, on the internet. I'm also editing mediachannel.org, which is back in action and back online. So please share that with friends as well. We're going out with a little song called News Goo, about the news business. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Wish you were as soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
Stations carry no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.